This Intelligent Medicine podcast is brought to you by Cedarside.com, your all-natural, organic solution to pest control problems, protecting people, pets, and premises. Cedarside.com. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Today we're going to talk about a controversy that is really hitting the world of complementary and alternative medicine and the field of nutrition. And it has to do with a very important vitamin, folic acid. But now we're coming to realize that folic acid may not be the real deal, that what we need to use, particularly for certain individuals, is folate. And this is very confusing, not just to lay people, but to many health and nutrition professionals. And so to clarify this issue, I'm going to turn to an expert that we frequently consult here on Intelligent Medicine. He is Dr. Thomas Williams. Tom has earned a PhD. He's an independent he is head of the Point Institute, which is an independent research organization focused on examining and disseminating information about the use of natural therapeutic options for treating and preventing chronic diseases, and that's what we're going to talk about today. And he also serves as the Vice President of Science and Regulatory Affairs for Orthomolecular Products, which is a very fine supplement company that sells exclusively to doctors. And we utilize many of their products at the Hoffman Center. They're very high quality. Tom has developed a wide array of products and programs for clinicians to utilize nutritional supplements to provide safe and evidence-based and effective lifestyle interventions. His background is in the field of molecular immunology. And he has since turned his attention to the field of applied nutrition. He teaches at the University of Wisconsin School of Pharmacy and the University of Minnesota School of Pharmacy. And he's a faculty member of the Fellowship in Anti-Aging, Regenerative, and Functional Medicine, which is also known as A4M. He lives in Stevens Point, Wisconsin, way off the grid with his wife and kids. I happen to know that you've got a very long driveway, right, Tom?
Yeah, very, very long. A quarter mile or so.
And it was tough this winter, wasn't it? This last winter, it was a little hard to.
This was about the worst winter we've ever had. Hopefully, we don't end up repeating that this year.
Are you laying in the supplies for a long siege? You're getting like your survival gear.
We got to get the wood ready. And last year we had a propane. Propane went through the roof, so we had to really burn a lot of wood last year. So yeah.
But you have you have a little army of assistants there to help you. How many kids out there?
Yeah, I have six kids. My first is venturing off to college this year, so we've got a wide range of children.
So you're going to lose one of your hired hands. So it's train some a replacement. Great. All right. Yeah. So you have written by the way, the website for the Point Institute I recommend very highly. It's pointinstitute.org. Point as in POINT, institute.org. Great series of articles there. And what inspired me to do this podcast today is I read your excellent analysis of the folic acid folate controversy. And it's one of the best explanations that I've ever seen on it. So compliments to you. You make a very complex issue understandable. But help frame the issue for us, because, most multivitamins and B-complex vitamins contain an ingredient called folic acid. But lately, we've developed some awareness around that particular B vitamin that maybe, just maybe, especially for some people, folic acid may not be the optimal choice, and we may need a more premium form of bioavailable folate to do the trick. So explain what this controversy is all about, please.
So the you know, this discussion started, among other things, looking into a wide range of nutrients, and not just folic acid or folates come in multiple forms, but a lot of the vitamins that we use come in multiple forms. And I was especially spending some time reviewing these to put together a book on supplementing dietary nutrients. And this particular one, the issue of folic acid and the folates, is complicated not only because of what we've really learned in the last 15 years or so about the way folates function, but also the availability of new forms that hadn't been available to us really over until the last 15 years. So let me see if I can try to boil this down. Folates as a group of molecules are a group of water-soluble vitamins, mostly found originally in foliage. That's how they get their names for folate. And they're found in a kind of a wide range of different forms in nature. So if you eat, you know, one type of a plant or another type of plant, you have sort of these different sort of molecules. And they have different amounts of hydrogens attached to them, and then what we call glutamate, these glutamate groups. And the more that are attached, we call them polyglutamates, because you can add up 7, 8, 9, 10 of these. Well, folic acid was a synthetic version of a stripped-down model. Let's say only one glutamate, that's why we call it a monoglutamate, and no hydrogen group. So it's a, you know, no, none of the hydrogen groups, call it fully oxidized. Well, when this was sort of invented years ago and discovered to be, you know, fulfill the vitamin requirements of folate, it became the one that we researched, the one that we started fortifying, and the use throughout foods and now in dietary supplements, and what we call folic acid. And it actually, as it turns out, interestingly enough, folic acid, the synthetic form, actually absorbs better in the body than some of the natural folates found in food. And so, you know, that was kind of surprising, but as we learned how folates actually absorb, remember I said in nature some of these come polyglutamate, you have all these glutamates attached. Well, one of the first things the body has to do is cut off all of those glutamates, so it has to strip it down to a monoglutamate, and then when it absorbs, it then can be modified slightly and go into the body. Well, what we've known this for quite a long time, that the active form, the actual biologically active form of folate in the body, is something called 5-methyltetrahydrofolate. I'll just break that down just a little bit. 5-methyl just means it has a methyl group at a certain position, which is the fifth position, so that's pretty simple. So it needs to be methylated, and it needs to be tetrahydro. Remember I said there's no hydrogens? Well, in this case, there's 4 hydrogens. So essentially, we need to get a methylated and a 4 hydrogens attached to our folate molecule to be active.
And this is actually something that people can now read on product labels, because you can actually look, and some products say folic acid, but other products will actually say 5-MTHF as an abbreviation for jawbreaker, 5-methyltetrahydrofolate.
Exactly. So this form has been thought of as the active form. And, you know, when you consume folic acid, the body is able to enzymatically convert it to 5-methyltetrahydrofolate, and it'll absorb. And for the most part, most people can do that, I think, fairly efficiently, especially as we add supplementation of folic acid, and people are able to then use this form. It absorbs in the body. And that's the only thing we've had available to us, except for a couple other forms. I won't, unless we want to get into it, we can talk about folinic acid, which is sort of an intermediate between those two.
But it's actually used as a prescription drug sometimes. It's used, sometimes to counteract the effects of methotrexate, I think, and for, you know, sometimes special purposes, but not usually in ordinary vitamin pills.
Right, but it is available. It can be available as a dietary supplement as well.
Yeah.
So what we've learned, really, that what's kind of the big news over the last, let's say, 10 years, especially in medicine, has been the ability to measure enzymes that convert folic acid or remethylate various forms of methylfolate back to that folate, that 5-methyltetrahydrofolate form. And there is what we call a polymorphism, or a change in the gene sequence of a single nucleotide that can make those enzymes less efficient. And because they're less efficient, the ability for the body to convert and create that final form, 5-methyltetrahydrofolate, is reduced. And because it's reduced, the overall ability for the body to methylate and do some of the methylation pathways is diminished. And especially if you have two of these polymorphisms, that is, both of your genes are less able to produce a protein that's effective at making this 5-methyltetrahydrofolate, it turns out that you are less able to do methylation. Of course, methylation is very important for a number of different things, including, you know, reducing homocysteine levels and methylating DNA and just a number of other processes in the body that require methylation.
And this gene mutation, or this what is sometimes called a SNP, or a single nucleotide polymorphism, it's abbreviated SNP, SNP, it's referred to as MTHFR. And we sometimes joke that this is a family program, but we're still going to call it what it is, MTHFR. It doesn't stand for anything that's not clean. It stands for methyl tetrahydrofolate reductase. Thank goodness I went to medical school and I learned to say words like that.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, it's really hard. This is one of those topics that it's really helpful to have some charts or some diagrams in front of you to show you all these pathways. But as it turns out, probably, I'm trying to guess, maybe about 15 years ago, there's a commercially available form of 5-methyltetrahydrofolate. That is, it's a monoglutamate, so it's not the polyglutamate that we would still find in dietary, you know, like salads or grains or whatever. This is actually, although it's sometimes called a natural folate, it's technically really organically synthesized in a laboratory or in a facility from folic acid. So it is a monoglutamate where they put the hydrogens on, they put the methyl group on, and now they can use the 5-methyltetrahydrofolate and use it orally. And it's been available as a product. One of the things that I bring up and I tell people is that it's about 200 times more expensive than folic acid.
So it's considered, it's a premium form of folic acid. But most people think, if it's so much more expensive, it must be the more desirable form, right? Or wrong?
Well, in many cases, it is. And this is what I think we're learning, is that if you look into the literature, you would expect that, you know, people that have these polymorphisms would always get an effect using this 5-methyl form and get very little effect when they use folic acid alone. And as it turns out, when you look at the literature, it doesn't always turn out that way. Sometimes the folic acid works just as well at reducing homocysteine or changing folate levels or some of the other things that are measured. And in other cases, especially when you have a homozygous, what we call a homozygous TT, or somebody has both of the slow forms of the MTHFR gene, in some cases the 5-methyl form taken orally has a statistically significant benefit and is maybe clinically a better choice in that case. Or in some cases, blending a folic acid with a 5-methyl may even be appropriate. So what we've really discovered is that, and I can tell you, I was just at a meeting the other day where we had a panel discussion with some clinicians and myself and a group of individuals, and I can tell you there's a lot of confusion, patients, but even among clinicians, about when is it appropriate to, what should we be measuring, first of all, in methylation. A lot of clinicians are measuring, like you can take the DNA and you can measure it and tell me, you know, does my patient have these SNPs? And then what do I do with that? And so a lot of clinicians are just treating the genetics as if there's a problem, and yet they may not actually have a methylation problem because the patient may have enough folate in their diet, or they may have other genes that are upregulated to counterbalance some of those things. So in some ways, I think having 5-methyltetrahydrofolate available to us is a good thing. But I think clinicians that have just jumped over to using it all the time may not be serving their patients as well in deciding when it's appropriate and when they should just, you know, when folic acid is going to be fine for them.
Well, let me summarize, you know, the controversy from the standpoint of some clinicians and now in the mind of sophisticated consumers. Many consumers now believe, and you can tell us whether this is correct, that folic acid is worthless or inferior or even worse, potentially harmful, at least to some people, and that we should be getting rid of folic acid. It's been stigmatized, and a lot of people are looking at supplements, and they're saying, "Feh, it's got folic acid in it. That's so old school. I'm going to get rid of this supplement because it's not a state-of-the-art supplement." Is that a fair conclusion to jump to?
Yeah, I think that has happened, and I think, unfortunately, it's been driven a lot by the combination of the companies that are selling the 5-methyl form and then the doctors that have been measuring the SNPs, and this assumption, and very poor assumption, actually, and not evidence-based assumption, that folic acid doesn't work in these individuals, and the 5-methyl form is the only one that will. In fact, I was at a meeting one time where a clinician, a well-known clinician who teaches a lot of other doctors, basically stated that in pregnant women, you know, if they have the SNPs that you're talking about that slow down the conversion of methylfolate, if a pregnant woman has this, that she'll have no benefit if she only uses folic acid and she must only use the 5-methyl form.
Right.
You know, I almost fell off my chair because I know that the 5-methyl form has never even been studied in pregnant women yet. Even though it would be assumed, and I think there's several different studies now that are coming out showing that, and these are just the last couple of years looking at using the 5-methyl form in pregnant women, and there's no reason to believe it would be unsafe or ineffective, but just the sort of, you know, from the podium to be able to say such things that haven't even been really studied yet as if they're already true is really, I think, confusing a lot of people. So I still think that there's a broad role for folic acid in not only fortification, especially from a cost standpoint, if we're going to fortify, but even in the role of, you know, basic supplementation, and, you know, moving over to the available forms of 5-methyl are appropriate, let's say, in people with known methylation effects or when we maybe have a genetic polymorphism and we're concerned about the fact that their methylation, maybe their homocysteine is high or other things. I think it's appropriate, but I think, again, we should be looking at it as we should look at both of these compounds and even folinic acid sort of in the middle there, all three of them as being useful and having a place in the broad role of supplementation in patients today.
Well, let's back up a little bit and let's talk about the importance of folic acid from a classic standpoint, because we know about certain vitamin deficiency disorders like scurvy and beriberi. You know, scurvy caused by vitamin C deficiency, beriberi, it's B1. What happens when you don't, excuse me, I got a frog in my throat. What happens when you don't get enough folic acid or folate?
So, I mean, the one that everybody's the most familiar with would be the formation of neural tubes during pregnancy. And so that's the sort of the most important thing that we think of when we see pregnant women very early on in pregnancy having low folate, low methylation, and we see neural tube defects. And so that's why we see fortification in the U.S. in the U.S. diet.
It's mandated grain. By law now. It's actually
exactly.
Legislated because refined grain is thought to be it's stripped of its nutrients. And so, as a public health measure, it took them a while, but they finally adopted this as a standard.
Right, and the reason is because most of the time a woman needs to have this in her body almost before she knows she's pregnant. And so, you know, the knowledge of her being able to supplement folic acid at that point would almost be too late. So the notion was, well, if we can add it to grains where it's in the diet. And if you look at the statistics, the increased blood levels with fortification have increased the folate levels in the population. If you look at an unfortified, unsupplemented population, you know, it's like 90% of people don't get enough folic acid, or have folate in their blood. With fortification, it's, you know, only like 10%. And of course, that's a minimum level. Now, if you look at the other aspects of what we need methylation for, now, you know, the last decade, you know, everyone's been looking at this whole idea of methylation, and now we're seeing the nuances of the role of what some people call, you know, one carbon metabolism, because methyl group has a single carbon. And this idea of methylating DNA to control gene regulation, methylating histones, which also affects gene regulation, methylation of other proteins, methylation to modify and create some of the neurotransmitters. These are more subtle effects and much more difficult to, you know, create an epidemiology link between, let's say, low folate and these conditions. But we are learning that, for instance, you know, people that have had a generally, let's say, a low methylation diet, which certainly would be, you know, low in fruits and vegetables, the kind of diet, they have a propensity for some chronic diseases. And now we're linking some of those with an inappropriate methylation of certain genes. And so we are starting to see that sort of this low level of folate over a lifetime, and a low level of methylation over a lifetime, contributes to these chronic diseases, many of which are metabolic or neurological, cancer in many cases. And so the link there is now becoming stronger and stronger. Conversely, we're also seeing in some cases, in the case mostly in neurological conditions, where the use of folate and folic acid, or in this case 5-methyltetrahydrofolate, along with usually B12, has been used then to, you know, change the effects. Probably the one that we think of the most and probably been studied the most would be increasing levels of homocysteine. And homocysteine is sort of an intermediate in this pathway. After SAMe, maybe people have heard of acetylmethionine. Acetylmethionine is one of the most common methyl donors, and so that's the methyl donor that donates a methyl group to DNA, etc. And when SAMe gets rid of its methyl group, it eventually gets converted into homocysteine, and then homocysteine sits there and needs to be reconverted back to methionine, and that process then requires folic acid. So you know, there's a lot of data linking homocysteine levels with increased levels of cardiovascular risk, stroke risk, Alzheimer risk, osteoporosis. Many chronic diseases are linked with homocysteine levels. And so therapeutic reductions of homocysteine have been done, and this has been done fairly for the last 20 years, using primarily folic acid. B6 and B12 are the main ones. And then another pathway that's available to convert homocysteine to methionine is using the methyl donor betaine, or sometimes betaine is called trimethylglycine.
TMG.
So,
right.
TMG. And so not to be confused with betaine hydrochloride, which
right.
is usually used to help with hydrochloric acid for stomach acid, but betaine as the base is trimethylglycine, and so that can also be a methyl donor.
So folic acid is essential. We're only beginning to scratch the surface of its applications, but we know that a lack of folic acid can be horrible in pregnancy, disastrous, and that folic acid can be used therapeutically for a wide variety of indications, prevention of cardiovascular disease and neurological disease, and even for mood issues. That's certainly coming into the fore. So this is a logical breakpoint, because we divide these podcasts into two parts. Let's stipulate this is part one. And when we return with today's guest, Dr. Tom Gwilliams, we're going to talk more about MTHFR, testing for this genetic variation, who should be getting very, very potentially more expensive but more deluxe forms of folate like 5-MTHF, who can rely on good old-fashioned folic acid and the controversy about that. And we'll also investigate why folic acid is currently limited. You actually can't buy folic acid above a certain amount. We'll talk about all that in part two of today's podcast. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine.